Today on The Grave Talks, the spirits of the Southwest. The idea of speaking with spirits for many years seemed like something out of a science fiction novel. And to many today, it still feels that way. To those of us in the paranormal community who know what technology and means exist, it's becoming more of an accepted reality every single minute, especially when it comes to the spirits of the Southwest. If one had the goal of speaking with the dead, where would be a good location to start an attempted communication? You, of course, would want an area with a storied history, a history lined with every human emotion and action, love, hate, drive, violence, jealousy, rage, and so much more. There's no better place to find a history of all these emotions than the American Southwest. On today's episode of The Grave Talks, we discuss the conversations had with the dead. The paranormal investigative team of Dan Baldwin, Rhonda Hull, and Dwight Hull, authors of the book Speaking with the Spirits of the Old Southwest.
Two of my favorite locations in researching for the book purpose would be Matty Earp or Celia Blaylock's gravesite, as well as the theater in Tombstone. Matty was probably more emotional because we sort of built a friendship, if you will. When we initially made contact with her a year and a half, 2 years ago, she was really not in a very good place mentally. She was what we would say, you know, kind of stuck in that location. And we, let me make this clear. We don't usually investigate or go to cemeteries to talk to spirits because, you know, why would they still be hanging around there? But for Maddie's purpose, that was really the only place we knew that we could maybe contact her. We didn't know where she lived in town. And this is up near Superior, Arizona, past Dan's house. So when we initially made contact, she was very still angry, very sad. She was willing and able to cooperate and talk to us, very forthright, but she just was still very in a bad place. So we got some information out of her, but she didn't want any help. We really felt very, very sad, I guess you could say, when we left there, like helpless. We didn't like to see her where she was at. But we let her be. You know, you can't, you can only offer the help. Same with the living. You can't force people to go to a better place. And then sometime later in researching for book two, we went back there. And I don't know what happened, but she was now in a much, much better place. You know, spiritually, she had gone into the light, if you will, had met up with family. She was able to communicate with us that she was, in fact, gifted when she lived. She used a pendulum, I believe. That was her tool of the trade. So she was very, very forthcoming. So all three of us built a rapport with her. And in fact, we invited her, you know, to come back to Tombstone sometime and make new memories just by visiting us. And she's done that. So very, very emotional, but good ending, if you will.
Tell me about that. Were you asked a spirit to come back to another place in a different time, obviously, from when they lived? What happened there?
Well, since Maddie had such a bad experience when she lived in Tombstone with Wyatt and the Earps and during the days of the Cowboys, and a lot of people that go up to her gravesite, you know, continually ask her about her relationship with Wyatt. And, you know, that didn't really bode well with her. We wanted to lend help to give her some new memories, maybe some good memories in making friends. So we invited her to come visit us, and we don't do this with any old spirit, but because we felt such a connection to her, especially me, we invited her to, you know, come visit us, if you will, hang out, come down to Tombstone, you know, see what it's like today. It's not the same. You know, we want you to have build some happy memories. But she came back and visited us several times. Her and I have kind of a code when she visits, and that's to turn on my cell phone camera twice in a row so that I know it can't be a coincidence. Mm-hmm. And I think it's happened 3 times since we visited her. So it's kind of an interesting little relationship.
That's interesting with a spirit that's actually able to interact with, I guess, current technology, for lack of a better term. Quite often we hear it where they don't know what to make of some of these things, but then to be able to somehow interact or trigger certain things, and maybe she doesn't really know what it is other than it's making a communication to you that seems to make sense that it's her. Tell me more about some other locations that you've been to and some of the connections that you've made with the other side.
Well, one of the other locations that really... was extremely emotional for me, as well as Dan and Dwight, was a location called the White Earp Theater. I think it's changed the name now, but a couple of years ago, we held an event in Tombstone. We do this every year to benefit Wounded Warriors. And that year, Brian Cano from Haunted Collector was our talent, if you will. So we had a group of about 40 people that we took to this theater. Now it's a theater where they do reenactments. And but back in the day, it was Hoptown, or where the Chinese people lived. And it was, from best we can tell, record-wise, it was some kind of a mercantile store. So when we walked in there, a few of us in the group, as well as I did, knew that there were spirits present. But Dan, Dwight, and I were really ready to kind of give it to Brian. We were letting them do their thing, and we were really tired. So we all kind of sat back. Dan and myself were in the back of the room, and Dwight was kind of watching the door. And during some point, they were doing an EVP session, and Brian got an EVP that was pretty clear. So they wanted validation. So they called one by one. He called Dwight up first to kind of see if he could help. And then it turned out that he needed Dan up there to do the pendulum. And Dan didn't bring his pendulum because we weren't planning on really partaking in the this investigation. So we borrowed a necklace from a girl that happened to be standing there, and they started conducting a pendulum session. Eventually, I got called into the mix to help this, whoever it was. From the moment I stood up from my seat, I immediately started, I was just overwhelmed with emotion, started just bawling. By the time I got to the bar where everybody was focused around, I couldn't even talk out loud. What ended up happening was there was 2 spirits present, a murder victim and the murderer. And the victim had come back to help the murderer cross over. Funny twist, though, they were brothers. The EVP that Brian got was something to the effect of, yeah, I killed somebody. So that was from the murderer. We ended up helping the brother cross his brother over in a matter of probably a minute or 30 seconds. It wasn't very long. It seemed like it was forever. But... the moment that spirit crossed over, Dan's pendulum kind of flipped around his hand a couple of times and then, you know, just like straight. And there was an energy shift. Everybody in the room at the same time just instantly started crying, weeping. And nobody really understood why. But it was very, very emotional. Probably the most emotional crossover I've ever experienced.
When there is that sort of a shift, and maybe take me back to the first time you experienced that. I mean, what goes through your mind when it's such a dramatic change and you're not really quite sure how or why that's happening emotionally to you?
You know, I have crossed probably hundreds of people over, spirits, including my own mother. I've never, ever, ever felt that energy shift until this. I mean, I've cried, you know, weeped a little bit, but I've never felt this much of an energy shift It was tactile. You could feel it. Even Brian Tanna, who's very much a skeptic, he had an all of a sudden allergy attack, he said. But he likened it, if I recall right, he likened it to the shift as if you were doing an exorcism. Now, I've never seen or been a part of an exorcism, but I mean, it was, I can't even explain it. You had to be there to witness it. It definitely an emotional from you're fine one minute to you're just bawling uncontrollably the next.
When you're helping someone cross over, what exactly is going on there? Because, this is obviously, it's somewhat of an opinion-based question, but we hear about it quite often. And we hear about kind of this, my understanding of there's this plane of, a plane that we're on, but they're there too when we can't always see them or hear them. But they're there. And then there's the idea of helping them move from that area, from our plane, into another plane. What is the process of crossing over exactly?
Well, from my experience, it is simply crossing them into the light, if you will, into the good place where all of their friends and family are waiting. Although oftentimes a friend or family member will come kind of guide them. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of ESP-wise assisting them, going in to meet their mother, father, brother, whoever it is, mm-hmm. that's taking them into this big, bright, white light, which, I guess it depends on your faith. And I don't practice any faith, but I believe that there's a heaven and a hell, if you will. But just it's your own emotional experience. So when I cross somebody over, it's going with their family and friends into this wonderful place of nothing but pure love.
Why, in your opinion, is it that sometimes they need the living to help them take that step? I guess I'm just trying to understand that. These are questions I've always had after hearing thousands upon thousands of stories. And we hear these actions being taken quite often, but it's rare that we really jump into the story, the actions, the thought process and everything behind it. So that's where a lot of my questions are kind of coming from. And that's one of them is why does it take the living to help guide them there? And why couldn't they just do it on their own?
Well, you're right. They should be able to do it on their own, but some spirits, and not all of them, but some spirits are stuck, if you will. They're afraid. There's fear. Maybe they grew up in a severely religious household, and they are self-judging, mm-hmm. or they're afraid of judgment, or maybe they, did something. It's usually fear. From my encounters, that is keeping them from going into this great place. They're living basically in their own version of hell,
okay.
Whatever that is.
Sure. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, it's almost if suddenly you're on the other side and what's going on is not necessarily matching up with what you've been told your whole life or what you
right.
you believed. And suddenly it's like, wait a second, this isn't what I was expecting. But there may be some aspect that's kind of like it over here, but I'm not quite sure once I go past. And as it's described, the light, I would understand that fear would be, well, what exactly is through door number one over there with the light coming out of it? It could be good. It could be bad. And if you're in a place where, I'm in a place that's really not neither good nor bad, but it's just kind of there. It's where I was. I can understand that hesitation. Have any of them ever expressed to you that fear, that frustration as to why they haven't specifically done something?
Exactly what you just said. It's like, let's make a deal. Door number one, door number two, door number three. Mm-hmm. I see the light, or I've had people come and try to convince me to go here. But it looks, really too good to be true. I don't know what's going to happen when I go through that door. Am I going to meet so-and-so and he's going to, go down the book and tell me everything I've done wrong? It's that, exactly what you described. they're okay where they're at. It's neither good nor bad. So why take the risk? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes they just need convincing, maybe from the living, you know, certain people just, they need that nudge. It's okay. I think Brian asked us at that event too, how do you know where you're sending them is okay? Mm-hmm. But again, I think it just depends on your faith.
Sure.
Well, this is what the spirits that I've talked to have told me. I have to assume that that's the good place.
And that was going to be my next question to you is how do you get them to trust you to make that move? I mean, to a lot of them, you're just a random person who happened to show up and they've seen you for a couple of minutes. And I'm just thinking from a living standpoint, because a lot of times we look at spirits as almost something with some sort of superpower. But I think quite often they're just like us. They're just over there. If a stranger walked into a room that I was confused by why I was even there, but then started really telling me to do something or go someplace that I was really unsure of, I don't know that I would immediately be like, oh, sure, because she said to do it, she's got to be right. How do you essentially gain that trust in such a short period of time in a relationship with something like that for them to take your word and to trust what you're suggesting to them?
To make a long story short, basically, I believe that they can read our energy.
Okay.
Much like, you know, I can walk into, and many people can, you can walk into a room full of people and you can kind of get the vibe of who's in a bad mood, who's in a good mood, can read their energy. I think it's the same for spirits. They are energy. We are energy. So I'm pretty confident that they can tell what your intentions are in a very short period of time. And then, you know, we, of course, go into it with good intentions, just wanting to communicate or help them if we can, if they need it. And most of them don't, but I think it's just a case of that they know your energy. They can tell.
So there's a bit more of an ability than a lot of the living would have, where it would almost be more more sensory than most of us have, that they can pick up on the other side, is what you'd say.
Absolutely. Maybe they get a handbook and they know these things.
It's one of the first things they're like, that handbook wasn't what I was told about either. I wasn't expecting this. And it's in a 3-ring binder. What is going on? So let's talk a little bit more about the Southwest and the spirits.
Let me hand it over to Dwight.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about the Southwest. Do you believe that the Southwest in that area of the country is more haunted than other areas?
I believe it's got a lot of hauntings, because the Southwest was a very lawless place for a very long time, until up to maybe 100 years ago. So there's a lot of violent deaths. There was a lot of people coming over, dying from not only violent deaths, but, diseases and such like that. So, yeah, around here, and, people always ask me about Tombstone because, we live right here. A lot of places are haunted or have activity because of that. There's just a lot of activity here, a lot of new activity as far as, when it was first settled. So it was lawless. It was, trying to take land from the Indians, and there was the battles there. So it was a very unsettled, area for a very long time. So, and that's one of the reasons that we like it so much, is that there's just so much history here, and not just, cowboys. I mean, you got the Indians, you got the Paleo Indians that were here, 10,000 years ago. So when we go to a place, even as, just a few miles from Tombstone, we find that there's actually, what I call like a layer cake of history. You'll have the Paleos there, you'll have, the Spanish from the 1700s, now you got cowboys, and then, recent history. So it's always a very interesting dynamic when you go into some of these places.
With that being said, of it being such a lawless place for such a long period of time, have you run across anything where a spirit is trying to get the accurate, the true version of their story told?
You know, we have run into that. There's a place not far from Tombstone. It's called Brunkow Cabin. It's a very small little cabin house, probably about 8 or 9 miles from Tombstone. Now, Brunkow Cabin was originally built and run by a gentleman called Frederick Brunkow. He was a German immigrant that came over here to try to make his fortune, like so many did. During his time and even after, so many deaths and murders and such happened, including Mr. Brunkow's death. He was murdered on that land and thrown down one of his own mine shafts with a 6-foot rock drill through his chest. And there's been all kind of stories about, you know, how he died and why he died and who killed him. And so when we went out there, and I think it was on our second trip out there, we were able to, you know, contact him, you know, kind of sporadically. He would come in and kind of, you know, tell us a little bit, and then you'd kind of lose him a little bit, and he'd come back in. But he wanted the real story told. He wanted people to know that, you know, it was, you know, bandits that came in, and, you know, they beat him senseless trying to find, you know, his stash of silver. And, you know, it just kind of went on and on and on, and he described his death, and we were like, wow, okay, now we've got, you know, this differs a little bit. I'll tell you another one that differs greatly, and it's a well-known name, is John Ringo, you know, from the movie Tombstone.
Sure.
His gravesite is not too far from here, maybe about an hour from here. And, you know, not to put too fine of a point on this, but he is one of my most absolute favorite Old West characters. So it was kind of an interesting thing for us to go out there to his gravesite where he was actually killed. And it's put down in the history books and everything that it was suicide, that he was drunk and, you know, depressed and whatnot. And, you know, he shot himself in the head. So when we were doing the investigation out there, you know, he told us in no uncertain terms that he was murdered. And it took us a little while, and we said, well, do you know who murdered you? And he answered us, yes, Buckskin Frank Leslie. And through research and talking to the people who own the land where he was killed on, which is still owned by the same family today, it just went down through generations, you know, their relatives found John Ringo in the tree, you know, when he was killed, and had talked about, you know, how when they were going to Tombstone, because they were loggers, you know, that brought lumber back and forth, when they were leaving to go towards Tombstone, they ran into John Ringo coming to the ranch, so they talked to him. And then later down the road, he ran into Frank Leslie and Billy Claiborne. And they were asking him if they knew where Ringo was. He said, well, yeah, he's up at my ranch. Oh, okay. So the little bits of the story, you know, start making sense, and you start putting the puzzle together. And with John's spirit telling us, you know, hey, I was murdered, and I can tell you who it is, and he did, it made a lot of sense. To the point where Rhonda and I actually have gone to the Cochise County Sheriff and the medical examiner is trying to get the case reopened to a degree to try to get the cause of death from suicide to at least undetermined. And, you know, because of budget and all that, you know, you can imagine the red tape involved with a 135-year-old, you know, cold case. So they were real interested in it, but we're still digging into that today. We're still trying to find somebody who may hopefully, you know, listen to us, look at all the evidence that we've collected, not only just the paranormal evidence, but, you know, as close to witness testimony as we can with the people who live on the ranch now. So, yeah, that was an interesting case as far as finding out something that goes against, you know, what is popularly known or history. And that's kind of the fun thing we do.
It almost changes. It changes history. If you're gaining the actual facts, not just what had been told or what had been claimed, you're getting this whole insight that otherwise no one would have ever known about. Do you think we'll ever be in a time and a place where things like that are much more readily or easily rather communicated from the other side and accepted as fact?
You know, I hope we get to that point. And, you know, the path to it, I'm not sure how to do that yet. I know there's all kind of, you know, equipment out there that, you know, and new stuff coming up that's, you know, supposedly better to do the communication. And I hope we get to that point. But, you know, as to how we're going to get there, I'm not sure. Obviously, you know, the stuff that we got, EVPs and stuff, is not admissible in any court. Most law enforcement, you know, doesn't want to hear it. Most historians, you know, true, you know, dyed-in-the-wool scientific historians, they don't want to hear it. So it's difficult. It's a difficult nut to crack for us, especially when we come up with something like with John Ringo, that we know, you know, in our hearts and from talking to, you know, John Ringo, is different than what the report said. You know, it's kind of a hard place to be, but hopefully it'll become more commonplace, and you know, maybe more people will listen down the road. I hope so.
That wraps up part one of our discussion about the spirits of the Southwest. In part two, exclusively for Gravekeepers at patreon.com/thegravetalks, we'll discuss what brought Dan, Rhonda, and Dwight together as a ghost hunting team. Does the Southwest always live up to its reputation as being extremely haunted, or is it more lore than reality? Whose boots and spurs are audibly walking across the floor during an investigation? How does empathic evidence play into their investigations? Who are the spirits that they believe they contacted for more than 10,000 years ago on one such trip? And what locations hold dark spirits so dark that even this team won't go in? Until next time, for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.